So, as promised, we've heard some very rich, provocative, and stimulating presentations. And we have a few minutes for questions. So, please, if you would like to ask a question, please raise your hand and I'll try and identify you. I'm sorry. Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. Christian. I think one's coming to you.
Yes, thank you very much for the indeed very stimulating conversation. It's a great honor to be here and to be able to listen and feel as well. Yeah, I had a question for Monsieur Bouffani, mm-hmm. Which, I mean, I have many questions for everyone, but I focus to Bouffani for specific reasons. Yeah. It's actually not so much a question, and but something more of a precision.
Yeah.
I loved very much your... elocution of the extinction of speech of humanities within the humanness of let's say before the colonial encounter, whereby the encountered subjects will respond by, "Who are you? I am a human. I am this." But I also wanted to add a precision, just because I happen to speak, as you do, some of those languages which the notions of Ubuntu emerge. It's also because it's been analyzed philosophically by Alexis Kagame, who's not connected to Paul Kagame, the president of current Rwanda. So it's been analyzed and again glorified as one of the earliest sub-Saharan African philosophical texts in 56. And the specific text is called La philosophie bantou rwandaise de l'être. And it deals specifically with the notions, the ontological notions of being in Rwanda, from the perspective of Kinyarwanda, which is the language. So there, Kagame proceeds to analyze the specificities of Ntu, which is the suffix of Ubuntu. So it's important, therefore, to underline that although it is indeed, it might be the case that the subjects encountered by the colonizers responded within those terms, it's also because, so the Ubuntu as a category is primarily linguistic. So what is the equivalent to Aristotelian terms of space, time, substance, subject, object? In fact, in Ubuntu linguistic systems, all of them end with Ntu. That's what brings a fascinating complexities already of what a nation can be, because already there was a connectiveness within speech. But this also is important in studying the forms of violence, such as the genocide in Rwanda. So that it doesn't, so that the anecdotes do not entirely overshadow the existing, or well, let's say, analysis, which are also useful to know about. So I am so sorry, but it's not really a question, but I wanted to bring that to the fore, alongside your particularly colorful and compelling delivery.
Jordi, would you like to?
Non, allez, en français. Oui. Ce qu'il voulait ajouter, mais c'est très important, et ça. Et ce qui est aujourd'hui, on est en train de parler de guerre ethnique tous les jours quand on parle de l'Afrique, alors que c'est la chose qui nous liait depuis toujours. Les choses nous liaient depuis toujours. Et aujourd'hui, moi, je rencontre les Congolais tous les jours. Je rencontre les Congolais tous les jours. Ils me parlent du Rwanda. Moi, je suis vieux. Je suis un peu plus vieux qu'eux. Il y a des petits jeunes qui ne savent rien. Mais moi, je sais qu'avant, on vivait en paix avant, il n'y a pas longtemps. Hein, moi, j'étais encore à Kinshasa à la fin des années 80. Je faisais du business à mes meilleurs amis. C'est des mecs qui venaient du Rwanda. On a fait des choses extraordinaires ensemble. On bossait ensemble. Il y a beaucoup d'amour entre nous. Vraiment beaucoup. Par rapport même à nos 9 frontières. Par rapport à nos 9 frontières, c'était les gens avec qui on avait le plus d'affinité. On avait le plus de liens. Parce qu'il y avait justement ce terme il y avait justement cette humanité qui était là. Et le fait déjà de dire voilà l'un est nilotique, l'autre est machin, c'est ça, parce que ça a commencé comme ça. Je me souviens quand cette guerre a commencé, les premiers mots c'était nilotique bantou, alors qu'il ne s'agissait pas de ça. Et donc voilà, c'était un concept total, le terme, le concept d'Ubuntu, c'était un concept total. Et presque toute l'Afrique, de l'Afrique centrale à l'Afrique australe, tous nous partageons ce même concept. Et aujourd'hui, évidemment, la guerre a cassé les choses, mais en espérant que, bon, Christian a encore de la mémoire, moi j'ai encore de la mémoire, M. Kagame a encore de la mémoire, donc je crois qu'il y a peut-être moyen encore de refaire des choses et peut-être pour réinventer ce futur.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Everything was clear.
Could I then ask Susan, would you like to, or Lawrence, any responses among yourselves to the presentations? I mean, one thing that struck me, Jean, about your brilliant presentation is, I mean, you know, we all have it.
Yeah.
A cell phone. I mean, we'd like to think that there's been progress, human rights, there's been a new set of norms that have been created. But what you remind us of is that right now we are locked into an economy in which these economies of violence are being played out right now, and that we are part of those economies. Mm. So it's not something of a distant past. Some people talk about the war in Africa, which is astonishingly neglected, because, you know, as you said, something like 5 million people have died, and yet it's something that doesn't really seem to register very much in our public consciousness, because it's almost normalized. And yet, Jean, you make a very interesting parallel that we rely on the minerals that are extracted in these ways, which take us back not just to the 19th century, but, yeah, you know, to a very ancient time. So it's almost as though history exists simultaneously, as it were. In other words, the past is very much a part of the present in terms of the economies of violence that we see still in play, and in which we actually participate. We can't distance ourselves from all this. You know, we are a part of this in various ways. The whole tragedy of Rwanda, of course, I don't want to appear to be picking on the Belgians, there's been extensive research being done about how Belgium, in a sense, created these racial categories that then proved to be so deadly. And this was because of a sort of whole psychology of colonial administration, which focused on races and typologies about races. of the crudest form. And so in that sense, to go back to some of the earlier discussions, there was a cosmopolitanism that existed. I don't want to romanticize it too much, but a sense of mixed hybrid identities as being an everyday aspect of everyday life. And then those complex identities had to fit into colonial categories, such as Hutu or Tutsi or whatever it is, because it helped in the process of categorization and therefore control. So there was that type of violence that was being played out as well. So these are just some of the thoughts, you know, inspired by some of the presentations, but other responses, Lawrence?
I mean, the one thing that struck me, because like you, I read Susan's book on how the other half dies, and just in terms of the continuity between food security politics to the contemporary forms that it takes, you know, whether it's in the form of kind of, you know, control of seeds, crucially, at the moment. And just the idea, in a way, of how perversely some of these languages also kind of, you know, move and across and between each other in terms of languages of legality and criminality. So if it's the idea of the contaminating and germinating seed that becomes the infringing copy, when it comes down to that, and so I mean a lot of the linkages that demand in a way a certain unified language, both of political resistance but also of alternatives, that rarely speak to each other, unfortunately. So
well, sorry. I have a couple of reactions by the panel, but also David Scott's presentation beforehand. There's been a lot of Cold War context, and it seems to me that and people still talk about the Third World. That surprised me because it was the First World, that was the United States and Europe. The Second World was Russia and the satellites, and the rest was the Third World, this great undifferentiated mass. And nobody bothered to recognize the differences. But what happened was that after the quote-unquote Cold War, nobody had to pay attention to the ones that didn't count. The United States beforehand had to be very careful of what happened in those countries, because any place could become a base for the other side. And any place could be, you know, I mean, something that would go communist, and this was the horror of the period in the United States. I lived there during that period. So after the end of the Cold War, who cared? So only the places that had rare minerals or that had something really interesting to sell, you didn't have to worry about it. So, and Trump, I think, is the acme of that. Trump is going to drop probably all foreign aid. There will no longer be anything resembling the budget of the OECD ODA, Overseas Development Aid, and there won't be a PL 480, which, by the way, was not just the very interesting things you said about it, and I didn't know, but also the fact that it was aimed at changing taste. And countries in Western Africa, for instance, which had always, and well, all over Africa, which had always eaten maize and sorghum and tapioca, I forget what it's called, were converted to having wheat. So now there's a lot of people that are dependent on wheat, and when the price of wheat goes up the way it did in 2008, when it doubled and sometimes tripled, and you go to the shop in the morning and you find that your chapati or your taco or whatever has gone up has doubled in price, this hurts. You know, this is a very good argument for food sovereignty. But the overall picture of it, and I'm glad you mentioned seeds, because you know about, I'm sure, the proposed merger between Monsanto and Bayer here. This is something the Germans should know if they're not aware of it, because if we want to lose our food sovereignty, the best way is to take that road. We'll have three companies at most that will be in charge of the world's seeds. So if we don't save them, and if we don't have all the varieties, the huge number of varieties in Africa and Asia, where there are innumerable shades and colors and strains of rice and of other grains, then we're sunk. You know, I mean, the corporations will have, that's what they're aiming for. So I think we've uncovered quite a number of monsters this evening.
Property.
I want, But when you talk about, oh, pardon, quand on parle du terme de third world, il y a un phénomène quand même qui est effectif. Yeah. I mean, when we talk about the third world, you know, there is a phenomenon. Since the 80s, what happened in the 80s? In the beginning of the 80s, I was in Congo. Suppose you're selling earphones.
Okay.
You sell earphones, you sell electronic. So you go to buy your goods. Before we were looking at the when we look at the map, because there is the question of the map, of the planisphere. Before, when you look at the map of the world, there is Africa, and then you go up, there's Europe. There's this block. So people, when you want to buy earphones, you take a plane, you go like this. In Belgium, France, or anywhere, England, and then you go back to Africa with your marchandise and you continue to sell. Sometimes you go like this, you go to the United States. But starting the 80s, what happened? They was not going visa anymore. You know, to get a visa since the 80s, it was very, very difficult for an African. Mm-hmm. So to make this movement was not possible anymore in the 80s. So what people do today, people, they don't look at the map like this anymore, they look at the map like this. Mm-hmm. So that means you have Africa, you go like this, you have the Emirates, you have Dubai and Oman, mm-hmm, and everything. You have China. You have Vietnam. You have all those countries. Mm-hmm. Me, my ex-wife, she goes to China 2-3 times a year. She speaks Chinese. She speaks Chinese.
Great. That's great.
She said to me, you know, this to put the Africa outside. What she said to me, she make it close. She said to me, when I go to here to in Belgium, she lives in Belgium. When I go to a Belgium commerçant, look at me first like that as a black woman. The man first, he look at me. I'm a black woman, so he look at me from top to toes. Mm. What do you want, madam? She said, when I go to China, a Chinaman, he call me behind his shop. He make me a tea. Yeah. It take 10 minutes. For 10 minutes, he's gonna ask you, how is your husband? How is your children? You're gonna speak, and after you make business. Mm-hmm. And it costs you 10 times less than Belgium. Mm-hmm. So people are looking at the map like this, so they go to this direction, or they go to Brazil.
But how many can afford to do that?
No, I mean, when you work.
Okay.
And people today, they don't think much. They don't look at the map like this
well,
anymore.
That's
something
right.
happening
yeah.
in Africa.
Right. Yeah.
So. I want to come to the alternative, maybe solution we can have tomorrow. You said little things are being done. You know, like with the money, with you know, there is little things,
things in alternative people ways. People seceding from the national economy.
Because the necessity create the
solution.
Voilà, the solution. You know, so maybe we can have. We're gonna build another future, but. It's going to take time, of course, but things are going on.
I'm very tempted on that optimistic note.
No, not optimistic.
Given that so much gloom has been a feature of our discussions, I'm tempted to end on that note. So please.
And we have a conversation
yes,
tomorrow.
Yes, so I think there are several conversations that are going to continue on tomorrow. I think intellectual property is a very important issue, you know, who shapes knowledge and the way we view the world, who has control over that, who has control over what we eat. I mean, it's extraordinary development. And here again, you know, we can, you know, the issues of agribusiness, monopolies, financialization, all those issues remain to be discussed. Susan's important work on corporations. So please join us tomorrow for these ongoing conversations. Oh, is there a question here? Please, sorry.
It's not really a question, it's more of a raising a bit of awareness to the place that we are here since yesterday. Yes. And I feel it like one of the monsters that is very present here at the moment is kind of a void throughout this program, which is the German genocide in Namibia. And it's very much, there is a negotiation going on for about a year now in between Germany and Namibia about how to deal with this genocide. Yeah. And I think it's very, very much links to what you were talking about today and even yesterday evening, the question of the international law and the question also of how trade is related to that. Just very, very briefly, it's interesting to that I'm raising. I think it's interesting to raise it in this context, because the only way to go to court against Germany at the moment is going through trade law, which a group of Hereros and Namibian and Namas are trying in the U.S. at the moment. So I think it's interesting. Maybe we cannot discuss it right now, of course, but maybe it's interesting to just take it as a case for further discussion for the next days.
Sure. David's done important work on reparations. Can the colonial past be undone? that remains a formidable issue. Well, that's another whole conversation. But thank you for raising it. I won't say another whole conversation. It is an extension of the conversations we've been having on how do we come to terms with that colonial past. But we would also perhaps think of the colonial present, because the structures that enable colonialism perhaps continue on in terms of these mechanisms that we've been discussing. And so sometimes what we might be sensitively trying to do is not just address that past, but say that past is still the present in many important respects. And surely that at least can be dealt with. And it's fascinating to see the legal problems associated with bringing these types of claims, even though they seem to be so obvious, isn't it? It's extraordinary that corporations can succeed in bringing claims to the extent of winning damages of hundreds of millions of dollars.
Of course. Yeah.
So then the question that arises is, how is it that a legal regime was created to enable this to happen? How is it that in a situation where property is given so much protection, to the extent we have intellectual property laws now, which have been globalized thanks to the World Trade Organization, how is it that those forms of property are protected, whereas people have lost their entire homelands and they've been occupied and no compensation has been paid? Some of you might know the story of Haiti, how compensation was paid after the Haitian Revolution, where the slaves of Haiti defeated Napoleon's army. Haiti had to pay reparations to France.
Yeah.
And Haiti continued to pay reparations to France until the 1940s. Isn't that extraordinary that slaves had to pay for their own redemption? What does this tell us about the legal system?
The colonized country too, you know, the CFA from France, all of their money, most of the money, they keep it in the Bank of France.
Well, I mean, the Greek payments are going not to Greece. They are going to German and French banks, mostly. The people who believe that Greeks are getting money from any new loan from the IMF or from the central bank don't understand what's going on. There's a circus going like this, a circle that it allows people to believe that Greece is getting new loans, but it's not. It's a circuit to pay back the banks without that being very noticeable.
So the fascinating thing that's now happening also, perhaps, is that you see all this, the debt crisis, structural adjustment, historically in the past, we've always associated that with Asia or Africa. Now it is becoming a feature of the West.
I was saying that to people a few years ago.
Except they call
they wasn't believing me.
They call it austerity instead of structural adjustment.
And if you think of the countries involved, it's like empire in reverse.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if we could see it happening to Portugal, the Portuguese Empire, I think they're called, to Greece, to Spain.
And the Dutch are doing okay.
The Dutch are doing okay. And England, who knows? Okay. Yes, perhaps.
Yes, we better.
Yeah. Sorry, the very last question.
Thank you. Just a little remark to that it's not only internationally. I mean, we have at the moment that the nuclear plants should be shut down in Germany, and now the nuclear industry, or this industry who was running them, or what, who made a huge amount of money, now they get paid for closing down. I mean, it is inherent, this logic. Always the industry gets paid again. Yeah, and we all kind of allow this.
So, yeah. Tomorrow, alternatives and solutions.
Right.
Thank you.